and, swinging in a wide arc, brought its knob square against the cannon's head, knocking him back, dazed. Eloise gasped for breath. Peter untwisted the cord at her throat, then held her. In the moments it took for Eloise to return to herself, Fulbert, too, recovered. Peter rose to face him. "I will see you flayed for this crime. I will be at the bishop's palace by Terce tomorrow. The bishop, ha! He will have you seized. The royal palace, then. I will put the charge before the king. You dare to lay brutish hands on his kinswoman? She has disgraced the king. You are the agent of her dishonor." Abelard took hold of Fulbert by the folds of his cloak. "I am the agent of her protection. The day you lay hands on her again will be your last. Do you hear me?" Fulbert did not answer. Peter twisted Fulbert's collar close around his throat, choking him as Fulbert had choked his niece. "Do you hear me?" Gagging, Fulbert nodded. "Answer! Speak! Your last day! Do you hear me?" "Yes," Fulbert managed, a whisper. "Then go. Go!" Peter threw him to the floor. The cannon scrambled out of the room, half-crawling. Out of nowhere, Fulbert's thrall appeared in the doorway, stooped and hesitant, with fear in his eyes. When Peter did not attack him, the thrall reached into the room to pick up Fulbert's stick. Then he, too, fled. Peter closed the door. Eloise had covered herself with the blanket pulled to her throat, concealing whatever bruise had risen. Despite her unease, she found it possible to smile. "A man of the mind, are you? What was it you told Marcus? You use words?" Peter said, "But those were words, my dear one." He knelt at her bedside. "Words full of threat," she said. "The threat seemed real." "There's the trick," he said. "If the threat seems real, words suffice." "The philosopher knight," she reached to his cheek, stroking, "your father's son, after all." He put his head by hers. She rested against him. After a time, recovering, she said quietly, "No wonder the hierarchs fear you. Now that you are returned to Paris, the council will send its subpoena. The trap at last. William of Champeaux and his white monk will have you where they want you. Threat of a different order." "And I will meet it." Peter pulled the blanket down to look at the bruise on her throat. He touched it gently with the back of his forefinger. She did not wince. He let his finger fall to the lip of her gown, which fell in turn. When he cupped her bare breast, a customary initiation, she pressed her own hand onto his. She shook her head. "We must not tempt the fates." "The fates are with us," he said. His hand went to the gold ring between her breasts. "And they will be tomorrow. Be off." She moved his hand away. "Return to your quarters." He said, "I do not want you to be alone tonight, not after—" "After that, I am safe, thanks to you. I am safe until the king summons," she smiled knowingly, "after you storm the palace tomorrow." "Mere words, Eloise," she said, "simply putting the possibility of the king's involvement in play." "Fulbert crossed the line tonight and knows it," Abelard said. He touched the red band at her throat again, tenderly. "There's the proof. I will be wearing a high collar." He said, "We need not actually involve the king, and Fulbert would dare not. There is our protection. Fulbert falls if we fall. And that, as I said before, is what makes him dangerous, not to me, to you. Therefore, caution, Peter, caution, beginning now. B. be off. We must find another domicile for you, away from your uncle's household. What of your cousin? That is for tomorrow. Now be off. I mean it. He nodded and said, meet me at the cloister wall after Lauds, before the light. We will take our steps in sequence, beginning with a safe place for you. She felt the crest of his love breaking over her. She brought her hand gently to his throat as if he were bruised. All at once, she felt the pulse of blood in her own fingertip, matching the pulse of the vein in his neck. That proximity was enough. She pulled his face down to hers, kissing him, shyly at first. When she lay back, she whispered, quickly. Sleep. When it came to Peter, back in his rooms in the porch of the cloister, was deep and dreamless. Lost in the labyrinth of his exhaustion, he did not hear the soft sound of his door being slowly pushed open. Indeed, he heard nothing until he heard the whoosh of his bedclothing being ripped away, followed by a loud bang, which he realized vaguely was the sound of his own head being slammed back against the bedstead. Dark forms of men showed in the doorway against the gray of the fading night. Of the several figures closing on him, one carried himself in a familiar stoop, Fulbert's thrall. Peter Abelard's half-aware mind failed to register the intruders as his mortal enemies until too late, when they had pinned his arms and legs to the frame of the pallet. He never saw the blade with which in one cut his penis and scrotum were severed from his body. The pain was as brief as it was intense, because he lost consciousness. With blood rushing out of the gash between his legs, he began to die. Eloise, from her place in the woman's balcony in the cathedral, took the alarm from Peter's absence at Lauds. Straining to find his familiar profile among the canons in the sanctuary stalls, she left her place, going to the railing to concentrate on those figures whose cowls had been drawn forward, but he was not among them. At the garden wall, his absence there, she knew. She rushed to his rooms. She found him awash in blood, barely breathing. Oddly, a feeling of cold calm came over her, exactly what was required. Lifting and turning him, she quickly found the gaping wound between his legs. Wadded knots of the woolen blanket haphazardly bunched at his groin had enabled a partial clotting that had slowed the outflow, allowing him to live. But now the blood began to rush again. Clamping down on the bolt of her own nausea, she concentrated on staunching the bleeding with strips of cloth torn from her own underskirts. She dropped him half out of the bed, with his head and shoulders on the floor, to raise his waist above his heart. She steadied him there. She rushed out into the cloister arcade, just as a trio of students were entering from the lane. One was Thomas Clare, a favorite of Peter's, and another was Theobald of Blois, a pair of Peter's protégés. Her sharp commands brought them to his room. Her example showed them how to ignore their own horror, to tend to him, and her instruction told them how to prop him on the pallet and turn its frame into a carry bench. She led them from the porch into the arcade, past the chapter house, out of the cloister, through the garden, into the streets, which were only then, as light crested the rooftops above, beginning to bustle with the morning market. She knew just where to go. The young men took care to move Peter without jostling. He was their worshipped hero. Once Eloise turned her back on them to lead the way, they began to exchange urgent oaths, swearing to see their master avenged. As they crossed through the stinking fishmonger's quarter with his crowd of busy stallkeepers, she whipped around to silence the boys, but was taken aback when Thomas Clare barked at her. It was Canon Fulbert, was it not? Instead of answering, she faced away again to push through the growing crowd. At the Jew's house, she banged on the door. Please, Your Holiness, please. Chapter 14. Gongless cowbells, silenced cuckoo clocks, empty oxen yokes, and pewter-capped beer steins lining shelves too high to reach. The Swiss Alps was a profane sanctuary to kitsch. The waitress wore a smocked dirndl dress with puffed sleeves and an apron edged with tiny rosebuds. She was a pretty redhead, utterly at ease in her costume. The lunch crowd had drifted out into the early afternoon, leaving the booths and tables mainly to the shadows. Kavanaugh nursed a beer, taking the place in, trying to remember when he'd last been in a dive in daylight. Not a dive, he corrected himself, but not so different from the Shamrock or Duffy's. John Malloy's arrival, when it came, was an event. He swept into the place like an owner, with high signs in two directions and a stop at the jukebox, after which wall speakers jumped to life with the first propulsive notes of Duke Ellington's Take the A-Train. Malloy half-danced to the booth where Kavanaugh waited, and he slid onto the bench with a small hitch in his shoulders that honored the music. It all seemed natural enough, but given the contrast with his demeanor at St. Aidan's, Kavanaugh sensed that his old friend's snappy air was fake. Kavanaugh reached up a hand and they shook. The aroma of Old Spice cologne hit him, the detail he'd first noticed at Good Shepherd. "I'd say welcome, but who am I to welcome you here? Home court, obviously." As if to underscore the point, the waitress promptly placed a V-shaped cocktail glass on the table. "Rob Roy's suite, Mr. Malloy." The glass was brimming. Rachel Vedette's Historia was on the table between them. Kavanaugh moved it aside to protect it from a splash. Malloy seemed not to notice. "Thanks, Daisy." Malloy's smile was endearing, if still not quite authentic. Kavanaugh was struck in these shadows by how laddered his friend's face had become, wrinkles, creases, and ridges climbing up the bones of his cheeks, past his eyes, to a heavily furrowed forehead. The skin was flushed, but his crow's feet featured tiny white claws as if a permanent squint had kept an otherwise scorching sun at bay. He was a faded athlete whose world weariness lent him, ironically, an eccentric glamour. In his brown tweeds, natty tan shirt, and perfectly knotted wool tie, he could, even with that face, have been a fashion model. Anglo decadence, clothing and apparel. "Listen to those rails a-hummin', Mike," he said, raising his glass to the swing. "In honor of Inwood." Kavanaugh lifted his beer to clink. He said, "Good Shepherd would be marooned without the A-Train." "A-Train equals Harlem," Malloy replied. "Who'd have thought the Darktown Express runs all the way to the Emerald Isle?" "You would have," Kavanaugh said, "the other day. You took the A-Train." Kavanaugh's comment stopped Malloy. He said, "What the hell, Mike?" Apparently, the other day was not on the table yet. That quickly, Malloy's jovial air was gone. They watched their drinks. They listened to the Duke's music, the depth of longing, Sugar Hill, the excited rush of Uptown Dreams. Kavanaugh said at last, "Did you get to the boy's father?" "Yes," Malloy grimaced. "Tommy hadn't told him about Camden. I was about to stumble into it. With a glance, the kid pleaded with me to hold my fire. Not my place to lay the thing out. Tommy has to do that." "Why does the father think his son is being expelled?" "Booze, cigarettes, curfew, grades, call it the usual." "All true, as a matter of fact. The kid is a mid-century Bolshevik or a slow-motion nervous breakdown, take your pick. The only thing he's on top of is track." You, Kavanaugh said. Malloy shrugged and sipped. He said quietly, Camden. Walt Whitman. Song of himself, exactly. That teacher fuck. He has to be nailed. I am going to the trustees. Kavanaugh said, The headmaster won't block you? I'll nail him, too. He just threatened to fire me for being a drunk, Malloy grinned. Which, of course, is true. But that won't stop me. I play tennis with the board chair, Rodney Evans. A bigger lush than I am. Pulls on his flask between sets. Malloy took a hefty swallow, then said, But I start with Mr. Rowan. I asked him back there if I could come visit. Morristown, not that far away. He said yes. I'll get to Tommy ahead of time to help him. Malloy's voice faltered, no counterfeit breeziness on which to glide. To be continued, as they say. He sipped his drink again. In the silence now, Kavanaugh picked up his smokes. He offered the pack to Malloy, who shook his head no. Kavanaugh lit up, saying, You saw yourself in Tommy? Tried not to. After Tommy came to me last week, I told you I put him off. His being gulled was the last thing I could deal with. But a blue rage hit me, and my mind leapt from Tommy right to Father Donovan. Bishop Donovan, Jesus Christ, Bishop? Holy shit, Mike. I went to his office. How stupid was that? He shrugged. What did I expect? Same old brick wall, fucking stiff arm. From there, naturally, I hit a bar on Madison Avenue. Shaboom, shaboom. The next thing I knew, Greenwich Village, here I come. One minute I'm on my knees in an alley behind a Christopher Street bar, and then I'm on my knees at the communion rail in front of you. He stopped. I'm sorry I said that, Mike. He shook his head, staring at his drink. Oh, man. Silence then. When he resumed talking, his voice had dropped. I have no idea how I got up to Good Shepherd. The A-train, obviously. When I saw you in your vestments, just exuding goodness. As I said, fucking epiphany. The sky opened. I saw, Mike. Exuding goodness, Kavanaugh said quietly. The phrase stabbed him. He didn't know much. But he knew that, in his case, goodness was beside the point. Malloy continued. In you the other morning, I glimpsed, intact, the innocence that was mine once. And yes, I saw Tommy. I woke up. What am I doing here? I thought. I have to get back to St. Aidan's to stand with that boy. So I took off again. Shaboom. It was crazy. I admit it. Nor was innocence the point, Kavanaugh thought. Something more like willful ignorance. What had Runner called it? Kingdom of the blind eye? Kavanaugh asked quietly, How were you and Tommy alike? Malloy stared at his drink. He had his English teacher. I had Father Quinn. Father Quinn? Kavanaugh said. At Dunwoody? The assistant rector? He was assistant rector in your day. Before that, he was a teacher at St. Peter's, my day. The junior seminary, Kavanaugh said. You didn't go there. But I knew about it, Kavanaugh said, upstate someplace. Glens Falls, Malloy said. Near Albany, boarding school, Natch. I did all 4 years of high school there before I knew you. Kavanaugh's breathing had slowed, a function of his wholly focused attention. At Dunwoody, he said, we passed ourselves off as college Joes, but you St. Peter's grads made the rest of us feel like rookies, like we'd missed something, Latin, for example. You guys actually understood it. Malloy said, you were, what, 18 when you entered? At St. Peter's, that's what we called delayed vocation. I went in at 13, too young to know the difference between seminary and cemetery, which is what I kept calling it. 13 is very young, Kavanaugh said. Fucking kidnapping. Except your mothers were thrilled, Kavanaugh said. Malloy said, at St. Peter's, Father Quinn was our Pat O'Brien, the fantasy priest, movie star. Malloy's voice had softened, taken on a disembodied tone. He called us his Knights of the Round Table, and we loved it. Total magnetism, masculinity, a jock. Kavanaugh could not picture it. He said, the priests at Dunwoody were removed. Malloy shook his head. At St. Peter's, he was King Arthur. We were his good soldiers of Christ, the cross and the sword, him on a horse, leading the charge. And you? His chosen squire. In my mind, I held his fucking stirrup. I polished his armor, beginning when I was 15. Tommy's age. Why don't I know about this? Kavanaugh asked. He stubbed out his cigarette sharply. Malloy shrugged. We few. We happy few. You weren't one of us. We band of little boys. I served his mass in the side chapel every morning during the school year. During the summer, I was head counselor at the chorister's camp he ran at Lake George. Do you remember that? I heard of it. Then I graduated to Dunwoody. Yonkers is a long way from Glens Falls, or so I thought. I expected to feel homesick for him, but in fact I felt free. I did not know until then how much I'd longed to get away. I didn't know shit from Shinola, but I knew that I'd been released. I loved Dunwoody. That's how I remember you. Your loving the place helped me to love it. And then, Malloy said, when we were in First Theology, what, 2 years later? Kavanaugh's memory quickened. He saw the place, the long, highly polished corridors, the gloomy chapel, Father Quinn striding into the refectory like a procession of one. Quinn showed up at Dunwoody as assistant rector. 3 years later, Malloy corrected. I remember the impression he made, Kavanaugh said. You could focus a camera on the part in his slicked back hair. Brill cream, Malloy snorted. Man's man. Priest's priest. Kavanaugh paused, then added, not to me, though. I didn't get the glow. He put me off. I didn't know why. Malloy shrugged. I remember that about you. Your skepticism about Father Quinn. You kept your distance. Kavanaugh said, struck me as vain, his hair just so. Malloy said, do you remember one afternoon on the golf course, when I asked you to wait with me while the other guys stowed their clubs? No. Kavanaugh leaned forward. What was this? I was desperate to talk to someone, Malloy said quietly. I wanted to talk to you. His voice trailed off. Why didn't you? You didn't wait, Malloy said, with a hint of accusation. But he shrugged. The chapel bell had rung. Christ, John, we played golf dozens of times. You could have... Why didn't you stop me again? He shook his head. At a certain point, talking about it was not an option. Not with you, not with anyone. What was it, Runner? What did you want to tell me? There it is again, Runner. Kavanaugh lit another cigarette, unsure what to say. What an unseeing youth he'd been. After a time, Malloy said quietly, at Dunwoody he left me alone at first, but just knowing he was back in my life undid me. He'd catch my eye at meditation, he'd wink. Sure enough, one day he stopped me during the bustle after Sunday Mass. He put his finger to his lips, which I knew meant, wait for the others to leave the sacristy. I recall thinking, pretend you don't understand and get out too. But I waited. And then we were alone. He drew close to me. I remembered from before the particular aroma that clung to his cassock, part tobacco, part Burma shave. His eyes were moist. He said in a whisper, "Johnny, you've hurt my feelings." My heart sank, just fucking sank. I'd hurt his feelings. Those three words defined my worst nightmare. What had I done to hurt his feelings? But I knew. I fucking knew. I had hated him, that's what. It was my deepest secret, but somehow he knew it. But of course he knew it, since he was the instrument of the Holy Ghost, who could read all minds. The Holy Ghost, the little turtle dove, had told Father Quinn how I despised him. No, worse, how I wanted him dead. Malloy stopped, a faraway look in his eyes. His voice had become even quieter, and Kavanaugh realized that he himself had leaned forward to hear. His own face was only a few inches from Malloy's. Malloy continued, "But Mike, Mike, do you know what I said when he told me I'd hurt his feelings? I said, 'Oh, Father, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.'" Malloy now was almost whispering, his words weighted and slow. "Jesus Christ, Mike, I'm sorry. How fucked up is that?" "It's fucked up, John." Malloy nodded. "I forgive you, Johnny," Quinn said. Then he went on to explain that at Dunwoody, things would have to be different between us. As assistant rector, he couldn't be seen as having favorites, so we would have to be careful since, of course, he said, "of course, I would always be his favorite." Malloy stopped abruptly. Kavanaugh had an impulse to tell him he needn't go on, but then recognized the impulse as itself the problem. He said nothing. At Dunwoody, Malloy was staring at his hands. He'd fallen into an inexpressive monotone. I couldn't be his private altar boy anymore, but I could be one of his designated acolytes, the holy hours, two or three evenings a month, sacred moments in the night, which were the intro ebo to the liturgy that mattered afterward, when all the others had drifted from the sacristy. Malloy stopped again. Kavanaugh realized that the inexpressive monotone was itself the expression. He thought Malloy had finished. But a moment later, Malloy continued with the same dull cadence. "We must put away childish things," Father Quinn told me, which meant putting away the shy fondling that had defined our intimacy at St. Peter's. "Now we built the temple of the Holy Ghost with the temples of our whole bodies." Malloy looked up sharply, meeting Kavanaugh's eyes. "Hoc est anum corpus meum," he would whisper as he pushed into me. Not into me, but into the body of Christ, which he told me and told me and told me, is what I had become. Malloy stopped speaking, but he held Kavanaugh's eyes. Kavanaugh longed to look away, but he did not dare to. He leaned back, too stunned to speak. Malloy said, "I'm sorry, Mike." "Jesus, John, don't say sorry to me. But it's true. I am sorry." Tears had spilled onto Malloy's cheeks again. "I should have said no to him. At Dunwoody, I could have said no." Malloy pressed the heels of his hands against his eyes, a cauterizing gesture he had used before. When he took his hands away, he was nearly in control. Kavanaugh said, "You were my best friend. I thought I knew everything that mattered about you. I knew nothing. I did not know it about myself, Mike. With Father Quinn, I was someone else, that's all. I was two different people. The one you knew. Runner, Kavanaugh said. All right, Runner. There was Runner. And there was Johnny. I never heard you called Johnny. No one called me Johnny except Father Quinn. But then what happened? Kavanaugh asked. It took 2 years finding someone to tell. I'm sorry that wasn't me, Kavanaugh said. You'd have been disgusted as you are now. Not disgusted with you, John. So, obviously, since I was dutifully submitting to the sacrament of penance every Saturday, to Father Quinn, for Christ's sake, elaborately ticking off my litany of venial sins, well, shit, what about my ongoing mortal sin, debauchery committed by concubinus clerici, sacrilege raised to the power of infinity and then not referred to in the sacrament of penance because my confessor himself was my socius carnalis? Do you see what good use I make of my Latin? Malloy forced a grin that itself seemed degenerate, creepy. He quickly squelched the grin. Kavanaugh could not think what to say. Malloy went on. But that spring of third theology, our class was about to get ordained to the diaconate. Remember that? Crossing the Rubicon. Holy orders at last. Our own perpetual vow of celibacy. My morals were in shreds, but still I couldn't do it. A solemn oath before God, I was to vow chastity for life. How about chastity for one night? I could not fucking take that oath. So I found another confessor. Father Donovan? Kavanaugh asked. On my knees, on the floor in his room, I collapsed. I told him the whole thing. Hoc est enim corpus meam, and all. Donovan and the others took it from there. You know the rest. But you were kicked out. Encouraged to see that I did not have a vocation. That seemed right to me. I was the occasion of sin. That's how fucked I was. The whole thing was my fault. You came to my room at dawn. You wanted to tell me. I couldn't. You told me to go ask Agent why you were leaving. Agents! Christ, what was it with the nicknames? He told me you left because of me, Kavanaugh said. He didn't mention any of the other horror. Of course not. I was terrified, more than of anything, of you finding out what I was. I just wanted him to tell you that I cared about you, nothing else. He said you had out-of-bounds feelings for me. He said that was why you had to leave. Kavanaugh paused. He was only now piecing the thing together. Obviously, he needed to deflect attention away from the real problem, Quinn. Whether you meant him to or not, Donovan used me, Christ, out of bounds. His telling me that made me feel guilty. It panicked me, made me feel that I was... Perverse, Malloy said with a snort. There's the word. But our friendship was the furthest thing from perverse. Not to me, Mike. Here's the real secret, the real disgrace. Malloy suddenly drained his glass and held it up, casting his yellow eye about for Daisy. She swooped by and took the glass. He brought his gaze back to Kavanaugh, now staring. He said, "When Father Quinn kissed me, it was your face I saw, etc." I closed my eyes, and it was always you. There's the grim fact of it, Mike. I dragged you out of bounds without your knowing it. I told Donovan as much when everything poured out of me. So what Donovan told you was the truth. It did mean I had to leave, even if Father Quinn had never come to Dunwoody. I was already bent by them. I loved you, yes, was in love with you. The purest affection, but still perverse. Bent. I couldn't be a priest. You'd have been a great priest, Kavanaugh said. What I just saw with Tommy makes the point. I see it again so clearly. What was special about you? Kavanaugh paused while the waitress placed Malloy's fresh drink in front of him. When she'd gone, Kavanaugh leaned forward to say, with careful deliberation, I would not have dared call what I felt for you love, but that's what it was. After you left, I never felt that way again about anyone. I clamped down. I clamped down as well, Mike. Ironically, the catastrophe made me chaste, a chaste prep school teacher anyway. I'm terrified of acting on my feelings for the boys, and so I never do, never have, not even close. We teachers are to protect these lads, not rape them. That's why what that fucker did to Tommy, what he obviously has done to others, so infuriates me. I see that, Kavanaugh said. Then he added, So you're alone? Instead of answering, Malloy sipped his drink, savoring it. Then he said, I'm a Yankee Mr. Chips. I have the school. It's been enough. I said, chaste teacher. Emphasis on teacher, not on chaste. I slip away from Lake Durham now and then in my cups. I head to Sheridan Square, certain bars where some guy will call me John without knowing that's my name. Good enough. That's where I headed the other night after leaving Donovan's office. Shaboom. Kavanaugh edged his cigarette in the ashtray with one hand, fiddled with his glass with the other. Seeing his friends so clearly was seeing, also, himself. He said quietly, What I've realized over these last few days, John. He paused, letting his friend's name resonate briefly. Is that what I felt back then for you was the best thing about me. But we are not talking about the same thing, Mike. I don't act on it except furtively and drunk, but I am defined by the erotic pull of men for men. You're not, you never were. How do you know? Comes with the territory. We can tell. You were the straightest arrow in the quiver, pal. Still are, from what I can see. Maybe not, Kavanaugh said. I was a Navy hospital chaplain. I loved the men I cared for, loved them. But I know what you mean, the difference. He paused. The straight arrow image of Jimmy Stewart was what came to mind. The aw shucks movie star meets Simone Weil, whose name he can't pronounce. Still, I'm not as unbent as you think, he said. Try me, Malloy said. The woman at the cloisters, his tutor, to his another time, another place, the day before she'd said in French, impossible, as if he'd propositioned her. The memory mortified him. He could not speak of her. Instead, he said to Malloy, I am most myself sitting at midnight in a canvas beach chair on the tar-paper roof of the rectory. He nodded at Malloy's glass, drink in hand. Malloy said, I don't see you as a drunk either. I have antennae for that, too. I see you saying mass, hearing confessions, anointing the sick. Isn't that when you're most yourself? I love all that. It's what has kept me at it. Not a day goes by that I don't help someone. At the hospital, I help a lot of people. It's just that... What? He thought of Madison Avenue, the corner behind the cathedral, how he'd almost fainted. He lifted up his glass, then put it down. How do you say, I do not believe, in Latin? Non credo, Malloy said. Huh. Why? That's what I blurted yesterday. I guess I knew what it meant. The opposite of credo. Si non credimus, Malloy said. We don't believe. I'm with you. No, I'm serious. I'd stumbled into a recognition. That's how recognition happens, Mike. Has to do with you, actually, Kavanaugh said. You're showing up the other day. The sight of you rang in me like a general quarters alarm. Man your battle stations. Were you in the Navy? No, infantry, Alabama, never left the States. Me either. But haze gray and underway, ship alarms. We were trained to hear the whole panoply of signals in our sleep. Seeing you that morning was like surfacing when I didn't know I'd been submerged. I went to my beach chair on the roof that night, battle station on the deck, seeing something but not knowing yet what. Then I went downtown to Bishop Donovan. I saw that he'd lied to me about you all those years ago. That lie was the rock on which my life was built. Not rock, therefore, but sand. I left his office, and outside on the avenue I was ambushed by those two words, non credo, the loss of faith, not in God but in the church. Don't kid yourself, Mike. If you lose faith in one, you lose faith in the other. There is no God without the church. Then I am in trouble, Kavanaugh said. All this because of a lie 14 years ago? Malloy asked. Donovan is still lying to me. He didn't want me talking to you. Obviously, Kavanaugh said. Then he asked, so what about Father Quinn? I'd never imagined it, but turns out what I did learn from Donovan. Father Quinn is long dead. Heart attack, a parish in New Rochelle 7 years ago. You didn't know that? Kavanaugh shook his head. The bishop showed me the obituary. He'd kept it in a special drawer. Kavanaugh said, in a manila envelope, R.I.P., scrawled across it? Yes. I saw that envelope in the drawer, a pint of bourbon holding it in place. What other obits are in that envelope, do you suppose? I had no idea Quinn was dead. I'd had no reason to keep track of him. Malloy said, I felt nothing at the news. Quinn dead? Turns out, I did not give a shit. But I realized that, actually, my issue was as much with Bishop Donovan as it was with him. St. Aidan's School protecting a lecher by tossing Tommy Rowan overboard. That was my issue now, and of course, that's what Father Donovan had done for Quinn, tossing me. A lie as the rock of your life? This was mine. It's what had blocked me from helping Tommy right away, made me a coward. It was about time I dealt with it. At the Chancery, I confronted Donovan about Donovan. When I brought you up, he forbade me to get in touch with you. He said the seal of the confessional was still in force. What a crock! How odd, John. You start living in the truth and it forces me to. I left Donovan's office yesterday and nearly fainted on Madison Avenue with what I understood. Not just his lie, but my own, going all the way back to my solemn vows. Even before I knew it, beginning with you, all along, at some level I've known. The life is a lie, hence my beach chair on the roof. Malloy placed his hand on the leather volume. Hence Abelard? No, that would be something else. Patron Sanctorum of lovesick priests and nuns, Malloy said, and he grinned. You're not involved with some Mother Eloise, are you, Mike? Some Sister Marie in the Paris school? How stupid do I look? Kavanaugh said. Not very. But I've heard the rumors, tunnels between convents and rectories? Also known as sewers, Kavanaugh said. You spout the old slander like a teacher at a Tony Protestant prep school. Kavanaugh forced a smile, stubbing out his cigarette, aware that Molloy's reduction of Abelard and Eloise, like his own a few days before, was a gross caricature. Molloy's grin made Kavanaugh uneasy. He did not want to bring Rachel Vedette into this. This what? This thicket of malice and deceit. But no. This was John Molloy, runner, his best friend once, and now? Then it hit him. Here was a good man to whom already he was explaining himself as he hadn't to anyone in years. And why should he not keep doing so? I told you before, Kavanaugh said, that I'm reading the Historia because of you. When I followed you into the park the other day, I wound up at the cloisters, where I met a Jewish woman, a museum docent, an expert on the Middle Ages. He stopped. Why had he characterized her as Jewish, not French? He toyed with the dead butt of his cigarette in the ashtray. Explain himself? But how? Only two things occurred to him. Just as he'd begun to drown, Rachel Vedette had appeared out of nowhere, correcting his pronunciation and offering him rescue. And her being a woman was incidental to why he'd reached toward her. He said only, "This book is hers. I have to get it back." Chapter 15. "I cannot live like this," he whispered to her. She was bathing him, leaning close. The steaming cloths had been brought to the boil in the great kettle in the shed behind Prince Isaac's house. For almost 3 weeks, Peter had lain amid animal skins and coverlets on the sleeping bunk against the wall. Above him were the shelves holding jars and pots from some of which had come the healing ointments and the clotted spider webs used to purify the wound. The room's table, with its lamp, inkhorn, parchments, and codices, had been pushed against the far wall. The Jew, in caring for Peter, had surrendered the room to him, taking his own rest in some other corner of the house. Eloise had come here from her cousin's place every day. She replied to his whisper with one of her own, "Then do not." "What?" he asked. "Do not live like this." "I am incontinent," he said, still a whisper, now an admission. She smiled, indicating the cloth with which she was washing him, if now at his armpit. "I know," she said. Her method was to respond to his bursts of despair with calm, mundane affirmation. She added, "And Prince Isaac assures you that control of your fluids will return. Why would you doubt him now?" "I do not," he said. "Well then, you should have let me die." "Not true," she answered. "They thought to kill me." Peter turned his face to the wall. "But living, I am punished in the offending part. I am disqualified now from being yours, a fate that is meet and just." "The only fate meet and just," she said, "is what befell my villain uncle's henchmen." "Ah, so now my own lads have joined in the evil. Eye for eye, blade for blade, manhood for manhood. Where is justice there? One dishonor begets another ad infinitum. As if the justice of God requires such mayhem, what God is that?" She answered, "The God who welcomes Christ's death in atonement for Adam's sin." "No," he said, "no, I will not hear of it. Then you are deaf as well as wounded, she answered. That is the only God spoken of since Anselm. Anselm, he said, is poison to the faith. The honor of God has nothing to do with Christ's death, which was for love, not appeasement. As for honor, the only honor I care for is yours, and I bespoiled it. She turned his upper body to reach the warm, moist cloth below his other armpit. Are we in the hall of disputation here? She asked. Have you yet again reduced me to the role of victim in your tragic drama? Do not make light of me, woman. You misunderstand if you sense lightness here. This is simply the refusal to die. My solemn request is that you join me in it, husband. Do not husband me. I used to say as much to you, do not wife. But that was before your own pronouncement, what therefore God hath joined, let not man tear asunder. But Eloise, he faced her, this was God, God's just punishment. I was torn asunder so that our marriage would be torn. Our marriage was false. It was a sin. Never, she said, never will I join you in that belief, if it can be called belief. I call it infidelity. Another sin, which makes my point. Can you roll over? She dipped the cloth in the steaming vat and wrung it. I would rub your back. That, at least, is innocent. Behind Eloise, Prince Isaac had taken a place in the threshold. Peter's eyes rose to him, and Eloise turned. The Jew's white beard struck her as always, like the white of milk, or of clouds, or of the skin inside her own thighs, which was an admittedly odd association, since the thought was that the whiteness of his beard was a signal of his goodness, his purity. Her thighs, so Peter would tell her now, were impure. The features of the Jew's craggy face fell naturally into a consolingly benign expression. Where once she had seen him as Simeon, lately he had been striking her as the prodigal's father, a man who could stand looking out at the lost horizon with longing for his lost son, with nothing but love in his eyes. More than ever, given Peter's mood, Eloise welcomed the sight of the kind physician. She said, "You have come to cleanse the dressing." "Yes," Prince Isaac said, "that too." "What else?" "To make my report to Master Peter, and you should hear it also." "No," Peter said, "not Eloise." Eloise said nothing to this. She adjusted herself back from Peter's bed to settle on the stool. She let the cloth fall into the steaming vat. She waited. Prince Isaac, with his three-pointed hat, had to stoop slightly to cross into the room. He remained standing. He addressed himself to Peter. "What I have proposed for you, I know now, seems possible. Lady Eloise is affected. It is right that she be included in our deliberation." Peter touched the sleeve of Eloise's gown. "Prince Isaac is leaving Paris. He was meant to depart weeks ago. He put the time off for my sake." "Until I was certain that you would sustain yourself," the Jew said. "Now I believe you will." Peter said to Eloise, "Once I knew what was possible, I was going to tell you." Eloise had clamped down on herself. She turned calmly to the Jew. "Depart, Your Holiness?" "Yes," he said, "to Ashkenaz, for the restoration of the Talmudic school." Peter said, "The kingdom on the Rhine, Mainz." Eloise well knew of the place, how the cross-marked berserkers had descended on it, murdering Jews, torching their academies. Peter pulled at Eloise's sleeve, but she remained focused on the Jew. Peter said, "The Rishonim have summoned Prince Isaac, the rabbis. They are rebuilding the yeshiva on the Rhine." Eloise choked off the alarm she felt to remain focused on what was in front of her. She said to Prince Isaac, "But Peter is far from well. How can you leave him? He needs your ministrations still, needs them badly." "I am seeing to his future needs," the Jew said. "The abbot granted my request for an audience. I have just come from meeting him." "What abbot?" she asked sharply. "Saint Denis."
"Abbot Adam?"
Eloise turned to Peter.
"He was one of those preparing the subpoena against you, forcing your disputation with Bernard."
Peter said wearily, "There will be no subpoena now, woman. No disputation." Prince Isaac said to Peter, "Father Abbot was surprised that you are alive. The talk of Paris had come to him that you had taken refuge in the Vicus Judaeorum, but he did not believe it. When I explained, he counted your presence here among the Deicidii as yet another offense." "I warned you, Your Holiness," Peter said. The Jew continued, "But he seemed genuinely relieved to learn of your coming back to health. I believe that he bears you no ill will, quite the contrary. He told me that the best young monks of the entire Benedictine Federation count themselves your disciples. The order needs their commitment. Your presence would reinforce it, even if unlicensed. On the terms you propose, he is prepared to welcome you." "What terms?" Eloise asked, with forced calm. Neither Peter nor Prince Isaac answered.
"What terms?" she repeated.
Finally, Peter said, "I would be received into the community as a penitential monk."
"Penitential monk? What? A life of imposed silence? Of manual labor?"
Eloise was aghast.
"What of your philosophy? What of the school?"
"The school is over for me, Eloise. Surely you see that. At Notre Dame, I am anathema.
But there is Reims, there is Rouen. Young scholars all over Europe would follow you anywhere. The rivals to Notre Dame would vie for you."
Peter and Prince Isaac exchanged a look, more than a hint of patronizing skepticism, which made her anger flare.
"Your Holiness, you, of all people, must see this. The wisdom of the Moors, who, with the Hebrew readers in Toledo, are bringing the ancient wisdom back to life, the rebirth of thinking. What you will be to Ashkenaz, Peter Abelard already is to Christendom. You know this. The church needs him, and not only the church, you need him."
"Lady Eloise," the Jew said quietly, "Master Peter's physical rehabilitation is far from complete. As you yourself say, the fever always threatens. A great danger remains of poisons and humors, biles in the wound. Saint Denis has the best infirmary in Paris." Peter put in, "Because Prince Isaac instructed them." Eloise stood and rounded on Peter.
"But what of us?"
She drew the gold ring up and out from her bodice, bringing it as far forward as the cord allowed.
"In a school, Rouen, Metz, even Canterbury, you have the freedom we need to be together in our way, with discretion and with our son. Prince Isaac interjected. Your son,